For 50 years, the iconic, irreverent, and incomparable Doonesbury has kept readers entertained and informed through Pulitzer Prize-winning Gary Trudeau's depiction of our cultural zeitgeist. His acclaimed satire has been prescient, provocative, and unerringly precise. To mark the 50-year milestone, Trudeau's entire Doonesbury output has now been collected in a celebratory package, DBerry at 50, the complete digital Doonesbury. The set includes a flash drive with a searchable archive of every comic strip published and a 224-page user manual, which takes readers through each year of the strip, providing historical context and featuring key storylines. In addition to cartooning, Trudeau has worked in theater, film, and television. He's been a contributing columnist for the New York Times op-ed page and later an essayist for Time magazine. Gary Trudeau will talk with David Stanford of Oblong Books in a virtual event tonight at 7 o'clock, which you can check out at oblongbooks.com. In the meantime, it's a great pleasure to welcome Gary Trudeau to the roundtable. How are you?
I'm well, Joe. It's great to talk to you again.
Wonderful to talk to you again. We've done a couple of events together, usually right around the election. I know we did one in 2016, and then we did one right before the midterms. And those were live events, and of course we're not doing those anymore. So you'll be in conversation with Oblong tonight with David Stanford. So, but we were talking then about these collections, usually of Donald Trump cartoons. This time we get to talk about this incredible project, which is to me is incredible in two things. First of all, 50 years of Doonesbury, that is an accomplishment. I congratulate you on that. That is quite a body of work. Also, this collection, this celebratory package, as I mentioned, is absolutely beautiful. Who had this idea, and how ultimately does something like this come together, especially during a pandemic?
I had the idea. It was in reaction to the challenge of what to do on this half century anniversary, and I didn't want to replicate what we did on the 40th, which was produce this massive 10-pound book that should have come with more screw and legs. It was very hard. I mean, you needed to be spotted when you read it, and we thought if we do a 50th, that it's going to be even worse. So I thought, well, why not digitalize it? Why not, instead of again just trying to anthologize it in one big package, why not make it something that's a lot easier to use and that's comprehensive? And so I pitched it in a meeting last fall to our publisher, and it took her about 5 minutes to say, yeah, let's do it. So my editor, David Stanford, and I spent the winter along with the designers and the technicians who worked on the project, getting all that work onto a little itty bitty flash drive. But it comes in a package with 200-page user manual and a poster and lanyard. It's obviously a gift for your comics nerd in your life. Or just people who have followed the strip through the years and wanted an easy way to refer to past strips. So basically that's what we did during our winter of pandemic, is we just hunkered down and through email pulled all this together.
I want to go over some of the uses of this, of how it can be used and referenced, as you noted, but I'm curious of what it is like for you. It is 50 years of work. There were some breaks in there, but that's still an incredible output of what it is like for you to look at that and see yourself mature as a human, but also, of course, as an artist and as a comic strip illustrator.
It is a kind of journal. There's no question about that. Of my evolving take on my world and that I've created for these some 75 characters, but you know, when you're doing it, I don't want to say it's just a job, but there's this kind of quotidian effort. You know, you're just getting the donuts made every day. And you don't really have the perspective on where things have been and where things are going as you're doing it. And you're constantly on deadline, and that has its, you know, that has its own sort of tunnel vision. You're just trying to do this one thing. People have you know, frequently asked me, well, what do you do when you run out of ideas? And I've always just thanked them for not noticing. it's not optional. You just have to get something out the door. So the goal is a kind of, and I emphasize the word goal, is a kind of steady excellence. That's what you're shooting for. You're trying to be consistent and create a certain quality. Warren Walker, who did Beetle Bailey, likened himself to a manufacturer of candy bars. He said, you know, when you read Beetle Bailey, you know what you're going to get. You know what it's going to taste like. And you just want to keep the quality up. And so that's the goal. Not everybody is built that way to create under pressure, you know, to be that compartmentalized. In the old days, there were no development deals with comic strip artists. They just set you to work and hoped that temperamentally you were suited for the work. You know, it was based on 6 week submission of strips, but you know, those 6 weeks might've taken 6 years to perfect. And it's the second 6 weeks and the third 6 weeks on and on.
Right.
Comic strip's kind of like a public utility. It just is, it's just there and, creating new content every day. And you have to be sort of temperamentally suited for that. You have to have a family that's forgiving of that. although I must say, in a few years back, I started working in television more or less full time, and so I had to step aside from doing the daily strip. And I can't say I miss it that much. What I miss the most about it is the ability to tell stories. The Sundays all by themselves are a kind of essay. They're standalone. They don't really move the characters forward in time. And that part I miss. But the having time for my grandkids, that part's great.
Back to the candy bar reference, and certainly without maligning the great Moore Walker in any way, shape, or form, but if you put a lot of sugar together and enrobe it in milk chocolate, most people are going to like it. What's interesting about your work, and I think fascinating and so exemplary, is that it isn't just the sweet, it is also often a really good gut punch. There's great depth, there's great meaning, and there's great insight into it. And even you can be reading along, and I've been noticing this while I've been going through the collection over the past several days, you can be going along and just be laughing, and all of a sudden, you know, you're in a really deep, even dark place where you are making some incredible points.
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's certainly, there's some intentionality behind that is to mix it up. And I was told very early on by my editor, he said, you can, this is like in the first year. He said, okay, you can write about Vietnam this week, but you damn well better be writing about football next week.
Right.
And his point was, you just can't always have your knee on people's necks. You have to let them breathe. And also remember that the strip, I think, despite its public perception of it, is not essentially a political project. David, my editor, and I once just checked back over the course of a year. We were just chatting about this one evening, and we looked back over the year. It turned out that I'd done about 15% of the strips on political topics. That's not how the strip is generally perceived, but it's mostly a character-driven strip. I wouldn't have any audience at all, I believe, if people didn't care about these characters in their lives as they unfold. The politics is an important part of it, but it is by no means the whole deal.
Gary Trudeau is our guest this morning. The name of the new collection is DeBerry at 50, the complete digital Doonesbury. And Gary will be talking with David Stamford of he's at Oblong Books, but also works with you.
That's correct. He's been my editor since the mid-70s.
And you'll be doing a virtual event tonight at 7 o'clock, and folks can catch that at oblongbooks.com. So I know you and I have talked about this, but I'm curious. I think people will be curious. When editors started to put the strip on the editorial page, how did you react to that, and did you get over it?
I wasn't happy about it for a very simple reason, which is that's not where the readers are.
Right.
The great Jack Anderson, who was an investigative journalist, columnist, of some prominence in his day, insisted that the column be put on the comics page, including at the Washington Post, because he didn't care whether there was some reduction of cachet. He wanted to be where the readers were. And so that was my main objection, is I didn't want to be put somewhere where there were fewer people to look at the strip. But obviously, the editors thought they were elevating me, that I was at the grown-up table. And also, it reduced the problems they had, because they could then classify it as opinion and put it on their op-ed page and maybe put something opposite it that represented a different point of view. And it just made life easier for them. But no, I never really wanted, they're obviously free to put it wherever they think it best suits their paper.
Right. In this collection, there is a poster, and it's massive, but it features, I think, 64 of the most prominent cast members. That really got me thinking, and I was kind of casting about within the collection of your ability to create cast members for the time. That must be really fun, to be able to take your iconic characters and mix them up with new characters.
Well, that's true. Whenever I have something that I, have followed down a rabbit hole, I'm interested in this topic or that topic, the second step is to cast it. And there, for the most part, there seems to be a character who, best suits the topic or a series of characters. And, that's a fun part of the process. And then if I can't think of one, then I'll just create a new one. The idea, though, is to create characters with enough nuance and specificity and that people will be able to tell them all apart. I'm curious, when you looked at those 64 characters, did you recognize all of them, or was it kind of a blur?
I recognized most of them. There were some that I was not aware, maybe from the earlier days.
Right, right. Yes, and there's some from the earlier days that simply because they were foundational, we included them, but who haven't been in the strip for some years.
I also found, so this gets back to what I was saying earlier of the reference quality to this. I initially when I got it and I opened it up and I plugged it into my computer, I was like, all right, I'm going to start in 1970 and I'm going to barrel through and I'm, here we go. And I probably will do that at some point. And I did start that. But what I have found to be interesting is to go to various storylines. I'm reading Barack Obama's memoir, The Promised Land. And I thought, well, while I'm doing that, I'm also going to read the strips that you started doing in 2007, 2008.
Right.
Featuring Barack Obama and how you covered his presidency. And I'm sort of reading those together, and I find that to be fascinating and interesting.
Well, Obama was very difficult for cartoonists because he's so measured and temperamentally mild. and thoughtful and careful about everything he said. And then he doesn't have the same sort of grotesquerie of physical characteristics that Trump does, who I've just been unable to resist drawing. So that was a tough period for people in comedy generally, just because, you know, somebody that careful as opposed to our current president is harder to kind of capture. I don't think you probably found that much about Obama.
No, there's a whole thing about being the Black Kennedy but it was still fascinating and of the time, which I found interesting. Yeah. You talked about drawing Trump. You've done three amazing collections: Huge, Sad, and the most recent Loser, and.
This... I'm lucky with that one.
yes,
book,
you did.
That book came out in July, and now it seems prescient. But you know, so
well,
I'm the stop clock who is, you know, right a couple times a day.
What made those interesting is, and again, we've talked about this, but what made those interesting is that your entanglement with Trump over the years and the fact that you had been drawing him and making him a part of your strip, he seems so perfect for satire since he came on the scene. You saw that very early and went for it.
That's right. I mean, it has been kind of a golden age of comedy and, you know, forget comic strips, just every late night comic has just been a goldmine for them. And then on these new platforms, there's J.L. Coven and Sarah Cooper and a whole new generation who have found comedy gold in Trump. And, you know, it's going to be tough for all of us on a certain level because we all, you know, our amps are all dialed up to 11, right? Just in response to the extremes of this man's personality and character. And so we've got to kind of find a new tonality to deal with what follows. Now, having said that, I don't think Trump is, you know, Trump may be going away. Although even that is sort of
questionable at this moment.
It's not entirely clear because if he holds some big rally on Inauguration Day and announces his candidacy for 2024, then we're stuck with him as a kind of shadow presidency for the next 4 years. And so, in some way, I think that's a certainty that he will hover over everything, that Trumpism will endure. And of course, he's embedded his unfireable loyalists in department after department. First, the DOD and OMB, and you know, he's going to have his little ambassadors of hate and chaos and misrule installed in places to keep the faith until his big return. So. You know, Trumpism is something we're going to be dealing with for years to come.
One of the things that I can never forget is when I think it was both events, but the first event right before the election of 2016, when we were in Salisbury, Connecticut, and it's a Gary Trudeau event. I'm interviewing Gary Trudeau, and we're talking about Doonesbury, and there's, I don't know, 250, 300 people in the room. It's packed. And we're talking about this collection of Trump cartoons and talking about, you know, just how this guy actually get elected to be president. And there were people, not many, one or two in the audience who reacted and got very upset. And I just remember thinking, well, how did they end up in that room? And then 2 years later, when we were in that same room, other people were there with the same idea. I found that fascinating because they're welcome to your art and to your work, and yet they are still very much in the camp of Trumpism.
Right. Well, I mean, that goes back to what we were discussing a few minutes ago, that I think they feel some affinity for the characters who represent a wide variety of points of view and who mostly don't talk about politics. So it may well be that they're drawn to the strip for whatever reason, whatever characters they identify with or whoever's stories they care about. And they have to overlook my unfortunate criticism of a politician that they admire. I remember one woman in particular who spoke and a kind of quiet fell over the room because she was clearly upset by some of the things that you and I were discussing, and she was grappling with you know, her choice, her upcoming choice. But this, I think this was 2016.
Yes.
And, you know, that there was something about this candidate that was really resonating with her, and she felt, I think, hurt that choice was being mocked in her view. So, yeah, I mean, we all have to be kind to one another, right? I mean, we all have to
Absolutely.
Listen to one another. And We have to get back to that place where you can stand up and say, oh, I believe this, and not fear, without the fear of being canceled. And I thought it was pretty brave of her to stand up in the
Absolutely.
Middle of a partisan crowd and to share her feelings.
There is, and we had to sort of calm everybody else down too, and I think that's part of it. I think that's why it struck me, because that there is now that dynamic, which is obviously so apparent these days. My last question for you, and I may have asked you this before, but if I did, I forgot the answer, which was, I remember a time when we couldn't get you on the radio. You were known as the hard guy to get. Rather reclusive. You would do your work and not really talk about it very much. First of all, is that a fair assessment? And two, was there a change in you where you said, okay, I can talk about what I do?
It is a fair assessment, and it was deliberate. In my early years, the strip was very controversial, and it kept getting thrown out of newspapers. Newspapers, of course, were my clients, and so every client newspaper that throughout the strip would seem to assign a reporter to call me and ask me what I was up to. And I found that so distracting to be fielding those calls, which you have to as a courtesy to your clients. And at some point, I began to feel like I was writing defensively. I was thinking, well, how am I going to defend this? Or what's my rationale? Well, no, that's not a bad thing per se, but if it uses up too much bandwidth, if that's what you're thinking about as you're writing, you know, will this make it into the papers? That's not very healthy creatively. So I said, you know, it's better, so I don't offend anybody, if I don't talk to anybody. and then I can focus on the work, and I don't have to worry about how it's landing. So that was the initial, you know, I just called up my editor and said, would it be okay if it's not as if I needed to promote it. The newspaper was arriving in people's homes, whether they liked Doonesbury or not. They could find it or read it if they wanted to. I didn't need to, you know, it's a very enviable position to be in as a creative individual, to not have to promote your work to get people, you know, to find an audience. The audience was there. It was just being delivered to their doorstep. So with that luxury, I said, you know, I can probably do better work if I'm not constantly focused on defending it. And so I stepped aside from it. And then, I don't know, I'm at 20... 30 years later, I guess it was Ted Koppel asked me to be on a new show he was doing, and I liked the conversational quality of that show. It was called Up Close, I believe.
It was
like a half hour of uninterrupted. You know, you sit in a little black room,
right?
And I kind of enjoyed it, and I thought, you know, I no longer feel the pressure of you know, from my client base. I've earned enough trust through the years, enough goodwill, so that they'll mostly run what I do. And I don't, you know, I've tried not to second guess editors' decisions about what's appropriate for their readership. That's, you know, that's just basic editing. That's not censorship. You know, these are privately owned newspapers, and you know, they make 100 such decisions every day of what not to put in their paper.
Right.
So I never had much of a problem with that. And since I was no longer feeling that pressure, I thought, you know, I'll go out. You know, I also have obligations to my publisher.
Sure.
Or to the TV show I'm working on, or whatever it is.
Right.
Those are commercial obligations to make sure that you're helpful in the process of finding an audience. So I basically, you know, threw that switch, and now I enjoy getting out.
Well, we're thrilled. We're very, very happy that you choose, certainly to do our show at least. I'm very, very happy about that. The new collection is an absolute delight. It's beautiful. DeBerry at 50, The Complete Digital Doonesbury. It is published by Andrews McMeel Publishing. Gary Trudeau will talk with David Stamford, his editor, and also of Oblong Books, in a virtual event tonight at 7 o'clock. You can check that out at oblongbooks.com. Gary Trudeau, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. Always a delight, and I thank you very, very much. I hope you have a beautiful holiday season.
Oh, thanks very much, Joe. I appreciate it.
Be well. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.